Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's December 3rd, 2017, and it's about 5 o'clock in the evening, actually, and this is a remarkable situation.
Right.
We are recording the podcast during a giant game.
And more
Daniel is not listening to or watching the Giants play football. Why the heck is that?
Well, there are many reasons, but one of the big ones is that the Giants this week benched Eli Manning. Eli Manning, who had started for 240-some-odd games for the Giants in a row, getting into record territory, one behind his brother Peyton Manning, who was second on the list, is benched. And it was a huge story in New York, and I will start by quoting from an article. It's not a letter in the New York Post. It's an article from a writer in the New York Post, and it begins with this quote: "They broke my heart."
Well, of course. They broke everybody's heart. I mean, who's a sweeter guy, a nicer-looking fella than Eli Manning? That's a face you can... I don't want to be rude.
No, he's a likable guy. He's a stand-up guy. He's an ideal for everybody in terms of bringing up their children, saying, be like Eli Manning.
He loves to go antiquing with his mom.
That's how he grew up.
Okay. And he is through and through. And, true blue.
Right. And he is a guy who... the fans have grown an enormous attachment to, and part of it is this kind of, he's not a superstar-looking or superstar-behaving guy. He doesn't seem that athletic. As one guy in the Post put it, he's Peyton Manning's kid brother. He's not your typical steel-jawed quarterback, win or lose, playing brilliantly or not. He always looks a little blank, like he can't remember where he put the remote control. And that is who Eli Manning
that
is.
That kind of reflects our society today. It's all about the image. It's all about the facade.
Except for him.
No, but I mean that, you know, it's ironic that we focus on those superficialities.
Right, but here's the mystery of him. So here's a guy who has he comes with a mixed bag. He doesn't look the part. He doesn't even always play the part. And just so we're clear in terms of the football is amazing in a totally odd way. He can look totally mortal, totally ordinary for weeks on end, sometimes seasons on end, and then he is amazing, and it's hard to figure out. He has had seasons where he has had ups and downs, and the team looked like it was going nowhere, and then it beat the invincible New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl. And he did that not once, but twice. It's unfathomable. It's almost as if David and Goliath battled. David won. David spent the next 3 years in the rock throwing circuit, had mixed success, and came back and beat Goliath again. It doesn't make any sense.
He will not always do what you would have him do, but now and then he'll do something wonderful.
Well, that's the romantic woman's part of this. But
that's from The King and I.
It is from The King and I. You know, so there's that. So number one, Eli's unique. Number two, there was no question that the people in New York went crazy. And I've never seen a reaction to any other player.
It's funny that the owner and the coach were so clueless.
Right. And here's
about this reaction.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that was exactly my next point. So number one, we have Eli bringing an unprecedented reaction with his departure in the New York fan base, number one. Number two is that the Giant ownership and management missed it. Going back to the New York Post article, right? His former teammates seem to have realized that Eli's status, nearly tripping over one another to post their shock and anger, disbelieving that the franchise they played for would treat a two-time Super Bowl MVP that way. They understood what the fans were feeling better than the men running the team. They missed it entirely. They did not know what they had in Eli Manning, which is bizarre. It's bizarre. And they screwed it up without belief. And when I say they screwed it up, what I mean is this. You know, again, another article says, you know, Eli Manning's quote in his brief comment, and there was that video, but he's at his locker in tears, What other player would be at his tears? He'll play for another team. He doesn't care. He wants to play for the Giants. These are his buddies. And they asked him, you know, why is this happening? And he says, quote, I don't have to make sense of it. I have to live with it. And Time says, yeah, but somebody has to make sense of it. And that's where the Giants failed. It's just amazing to me that in an organization as sophisticated as the NFL, who's really struggling now to figure out what they have and what they don't have as they lose fans, when they actually have something, they don't even see it in front of their faces. It's the biggest fail you can possibly imagine, and it's stunning. It's almost as stunning as Eli's victories that the Giants screw this up so badly, and they're going to pay for it for a number of years. So here we are doing the podcast during the Giant game.
Mourning the loss of Eli Manning.
I'll buck up. Right. Let's get on with the season.
The season, the Christmas season has begun. We seem to have some decor around Limeport.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to our head elf, Dixon Cuff, and quite a spectacular display going on.
Well, he has made a discovery that you have to give him credit for. You see those lights, how do we describe those laser lights? Laser show lights that people put on their houses?
Yeah, you see them on late night TV.
Okay, and they flash them on houses, and they look pretty cheesy, and they are pretty cheesy. But what Dixon has discovered, I suspect inadvertently, is that when you put them on trees, they look amazing.
Yes.
Amazing. Yes. It's a whole different thing. It's like you spent $100,000 to string lights on your trees, only it's better than that.
Yeah.
So, because the wind moves the trees. It's an amazing effect.
So, and there is also a delightful plastic snowman that lights up.
Let's leave on a high note. But so you were gonna you've identified the longest.
Yeah, though that both in the area there's many festivities, right. And in the local paper noted that nearby in Perkasie, the home of our favorite reporter Armand Evers,
right.
Is actually renowned for having the oldest community organized tree lighting ceremony,
right.
In the United States. It's been going on for 108 years.
That's a long time.
Our hats off the community of
hats off. Hats off. Hats off. So we out of the clear blue, we saw a show on Amazon Prime this week that we both thought was great. And it's called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And it's a show set in 1958 New York with main character Miriam Midge Maisel, a 26-year-old mother of two, devoted housewife, and her husband has some kind of trading job. And his ambition is to be a stand-up comic. And as a dutiful wife, she supports that ambition and goes down to those downtown clubs to help him out. And then for...
One thing leads to another.
One thing leads to another.
And turns out she's the comedian in the family.
She leaves him and she gets drunk and she stumbles down there and she's the one with the gift.
So this is this was dreamed up by Amy Sherman Palladino.
Right.
Okay. Who's the creator of Gilmore Girls.
Her and her husband, Daniel Palladino.
Yes. We happen to be experts on Gilmore Girls because there was a Gilmore Girls marathon going on TV during Thanksgiving weekend, and Sadie had it on every minute.
Right. Sadie's the expert.
Sadie is a real fan of the Gilmore Girls. And so now we are experts.
I think it's important to note, I'll just say, I'm not a fan of the Gilmore Girls, but I only bring that up because I'm a fan of this show. Okay? In other words, even if you're lukewarm in the Gilmore Girls, that shouldn't put you off the show.
It's got a lot of fun aspects to it. Yeah. It's mid-century. We're all about, you know, we're all charmed by mid-century
retro
decor, yeah. And
in space,
you know, sensibilities, you know, and aesthetics.
They invest a lot in it. That's something that came up, you know, with the Mad Men show. It wasn't just that it was set in the early 60s. They spent a lot of money to really show that decor and that fashion sensibility in a serious way. And they've done the same thing here.
Uh-huh.
And so they're rewarded with that. And the right. other element in it.
So it's eye candy.
It's eye candy. And,
yes. And we like comedy.
Number one, it's funny.
It is funny.
There's no description, no analysis. It's funny. Rachel Brosnahan plays the lead, who's going to be the fledgling stand-up comic. She's funny. We can analyze it to death. The Times already has written an article about how it's very interesting, showing how women in comedy, who cares? She's funny. The show is funny. There's another piece of it that is being written at, and we had a piece from The Tablet, which is a Jewish publication, which is that the show is about Jewish main characters, and it's no accident. Their interview here with Amy Sherman-Palladino is that they very much wanted to show that kind of Jewish stand-up comedian sensibility and to have it in that kind of a setting. And you were pointing out, Tamsin, that there are some aspects of Jewish religion and Jewish law that they couldn't get quite right.
So. Well, the Tablet does criticize to some extent, saying there are a few head scratchers from a technical Jewish perspective, like the fact that Midge's butcher sells pork, or the fact that Midge's family regularly attends shul but seems to skip Kol Nidre,
which is the night before Yom Kippur, where the big events take place. Somehow they're not in temple, so none of that makes any sense.
This went directly over my head. Maybe it's something that resonated with you.
No, I just enjoy the show. I don't care about that. But here's what is funny, and that is that in the interview with Ms. Sherman-Palladino
for this article in Tablet.
She identifies this as her first overtly Jewish project, but she says that the Gilmore Girls was coded, that they were writing Jewish dialogue, getting this, Sadie, into WASP mouths. And this is the quote from Sherman Palladino. The family dynamics for both Lorelai and Rory have a similar sort of pattern as the characters Mrs. Maisel, a rhythm and a verbal one-upmanship that is a Jewish thing that for that show we put in Connecticut.
Which, when you think about it, is really true. You don't have that kind of patter between a couple of WASPs in Connecticut.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, that kind of caught me by surprise. And Sadie, you'll have to tell us whether how that strikes you as a positive or a negative.
But so we've only seen one episode, but...
It's worth...
We're sold.
I'm sold. So there was an article, speaking of Jewish girls standing out, there was an article, they call her Supergirl, about a girl who is in the Times, about a girl who's a power lifter who is an Orthodox Jew. She's 16 years old. She's setting records for powerlifting. She lives in Fairlawn, New Jersey. She is in, surprisingly, a family of power lifters, and her father and her older brother were already doing powerlifting. They included her in that. Her mother, of course, gets the best line. She says she cheered on her family and joked that her super strong children shirk family chores. Quote, they're lifting in the 300 to 350 pound range, but you should be there when I asked them to carry in the packages. So they're not scoring there.
To my world.
Exactly. But the funny thing about this story, too, and where this girl's benefiting, and it's written from the perspective of she being limited by the fact that she's very religious and she's an Orthodox background and she can only compete in certain kind of settings. In fact, she's benefiting from that. She can't compete on Saturdays. But what that often means is the women's powerlifting competition is Saturday. She lifts with the men on Sunday. And she does better when she lifts with the men. And she openly says, I enjoy lifting with the men. The men are more physically psyched. I actually prefer lifting with them. And my guess is she gets higher scores because she lifts with the men. And she has details about heavy metal music, etc. But in any event, maybe she's actually getting a benefit from sticking to the kashrut laws and the like.
I hope our audience is noting how, with this discussion of these various topics, these New York Jewish topics, you've slipped into your sort of New York lingo.
Have I?
Yeah, you're talking very fast.
All right.
And it's only funny.
It can only make the podcast
it's funny.
Better.
It's like with your people.
I did say kashrut. Go ahead. You want to bring us back to Earth, namely geology.
Oh, yeah. One of the books recommended in the Wall Street Journal, or at least reviewed in the Wall Street Journal this week, is called Reading the Rocks: How Victorian Geologists Discovered the Secret of Life by Brenda Maddox. And it sounds like an interesting book if you're interested in 19th century Victorian, interests. Okay, or if you're interested in the history of geology.
That's
okay?
A big caveat. Yes, go ahead.
And, it does point out that the woman who wrote it first got interested in writing about Victorian geologists because of her fascination with George Eliot.
Oh, gosh.
Victorian novelist whose real name was Mary Ann Evans and happened to be an ardent geologist herself.
What?
A great collector of fossils with her life partner, George Henry Lewis.
I think you make this stuff up.
No, no, no. And it turns out she and George Eliot and George Lewis read through Darwin's Origin 2 days after it's published.
Okay.
So they were enthusiasts. Anyway, it seems like a fairly interesting book about how geology develops during this period. It's in the 19th century that there is a lot of fascination with collecting and inspecting, and people have curiosity cabinets full of fossils and insects and miscellaneous objects that have become of interest lately around here, and they're just developing geology as a real discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And this will lead to the writing by Charles Lyell of The Principles of Geology, which will be read by Charles Darwin and will be part of, his kind of impetus, what would you call it, inspiration for going on to his own kind of discoveries and realizations. So sounds like a fun book. It also, of course, the review, which was written by Sandra Herbert, seems like another woman interested in geology.
That's the sixth one.
In the tradition of Wall Street Journal reviews, is not quite happy with what hasn't been included in this book.
Oh, is that
and
right?
She spends part of the review saying, yes, but it didn't mention the people who are focused on the strata, etc.
Yeah, well,
so that went a little over my head. But she does say it's a short but absorbing book for the general reader presumes no prior knowledge of geology.
Well,
thank you.
Sometimes the reviewers are out to show off that they're experts in the course of writing a review.
I guess you want sort of an expert to review it.
Yes, but you don't have to show off that's who you are. I mean, I don't think that's necessary.
But I'm not really sure it tells us non-experts whether we'll enjoy it.
Okay, so the other big story, now this is not that big a story, it's just kind of interesting that there is this fellow Shohei Ohtani, who's a Japanese phenom, or perhaps he's a Japanese phenom, who's going to come to the U.S. to play baseball in the major leagues. And he's very young, he's 23 years old, and what's really unique about him, there are already Japanese players in the U.S., is that he both pitches and hits. He plays the field and he takes them out.
Well, you told me that's the new thing.
Well, no, I'm told you it's going to be the new thing at the end of this podcast because he is, right now, he is unique, all right? They're unique in this sense. No one in the major leagues does this, okay?
Not to this extent.
No,
but
not
there
at all.
There have been pitchers creeping in who are not an embarrassment when they get up to the plate.
That's true, but that's different.
On the Mets, even.
But it's one thing not to be an embarrassment when your time comes up.
I understand, but it seems
No. We're talking about a guy who would on the days he's not pitching, play right field and bat four times a game while playing right
field.
Sounds
like a real man.
Yes, he does. He does. But the point is, no one does that. And
why do they do it in Japan?
They don't. He does it.
Only he does it. So it's not a coming thing. He's just an aberration?
Yeah, he's an aberration. He's unique. And maybe he won't be. The question is, what will the major league teams who sign him want him to do? And that's what's being debated avidly, this article and other places. If you sign him, are you signing him just to pitch? Are you signing him just to play right field? Or are you signing him to do both? No lesser an expert than the Mets general manager, Sandy Alderson, in being open-minded, which is unusual for Sandy, says, look, this is an entertainment business. In other words, there's some value in having a guy who's unique. Maybe you'd let him do both. And yet that is so much against the grain that the only example that comes to mind is Babe Ruth, who I think you know, Tamsin, a million years ago when Babe Ruth played in the 20s, he was originally a pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And he had great success as a pitcher, but people couldn't help noticing him hitting the ball out of the park whenever he batted, and they made him to a regular right fielder.
So what kind of pitcher is this guy? Is he doing like the super fast?
Well, that's interesting. He throws 100 miles an hour, which of course gets people excited. But But, and this is
Can you really do that and play every day and so on?
Sure,
really?
No, yes.
Doesn't that risk something?
Well, these guys are cautious. And when I say these guys, it's the fellows who run the teams. And they're gonna almost certainly not allow him to do this because they're concerned about injury, which is what you're getting to. Although, you know, they're such solid traditionalists. I actually think that I would do it differently. I think I think the future of the game is in versatility. And I think that the game would be rewarded if they did something as radical as saying, you know something, rather than have 24 players on a team on a roster with everybody being a specialist, let's have teams made of 15 players in which everybody's not a specialist, in which people would have to hit and pitch to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And what would that mean? That would mean the pitching is a little less shutout-like, fewer strikeouts, which would be good for the game. That would mean you'd have fewer injuries because people would prize the ability to be athletic and limber and the like and do a variety of things as opposed to do things that blow out your shoulder. Mm-hmm. And that could be the future of the game.
Also, it might help develop more of an star quality and interest in individual players,
Absolutely.
A following.
Exactly.
Because there are 15 to know.
And as we know from Eli Manning, it's not all about success.
Mm-hmm.
It's about going on the journey with the player. And that journey could include, you know, seeing what you could do with third base when you weren't pitching. And even if you're not the best third baseman in the world, you can play third base. And it's not so strange to think this way because you and I have been discussing, when these players are in high school and college, they're just the best players. It is hardly unusual to have the fellow who's becomes the pitcher to have been the best hitter on the high school team
mm-hmm.
and the best hitter on the college team.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
they're made to specialize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, not immediately, but if the major leagues thought about it, and this will be a fight with the unions,
mm-hmm.
They ought to go to lesser specialization and smaller rosters. It would save them a lot of money. They'd have fewer injuries. And I think it wouldn't hurt them at the gate. So this could be a funny way to get into that subject, and we'll see.
All right. Museum update.
Yes.
There's a review. I don't know if it was a review, really, or an article about an exhibition that just opened in Mexico City at the Palace of Fine Arts.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Mexican Red, the cochineal. In art.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the cochineal mm-hmm. is a bug.
Mm-hmm.
And it exists by eating the prickly pear cactus. And indigenous to Mexico, a certain part of Mexico. And you dry the females mm-hmm. and crush them. And they produce an extraordinary red color
mm-hmm.
For dye used in textiles, used as a pigment in painting, etc. Highly prized, jealously guarded. Found in both, I guess, Mexico and Peru at a certain point. When Spain comes to Mexico in 1521, they... of course, discover not only silver and gold, but also this cochineal red.
Mm.
And within a couple of decades, it's a major export to Spain, second only to silver.
Really?
And more profitable than gold at this point. The secrets to raising it and creating it, jealously guarded and highly prized. It will be the red in European art for several centuries. Tintoretto, Titian, Velasquez use it. The Brits mm-hmm. use it to dye those uniforms
mm-hmm.
For the military. It is an important, important color until the 19th century. And that's when synthetic
mm-hmm.
Colors are being developed, and they're much cheaper, easier to produce, less labor intensive, etc. So they take over, never quite the strong, amazing, lively color that Van Gogh so loved. And in fact, now people are turning a little bit back to the cochineal because it's natural. You know that all that fuss about... Red dye number 9 or
right,
something like that in things that were harmful. So it seems like an interesting exhibition. They even have the paint box of Turner that includes some Coach Neil in it. And it's at the Palace of Fine Arts, which is a fantastic building, which the kids and I went to once many years ago, almost 20 years ago, and saw the, I can't really pronounce it, the folkloric troupe of Mexico do a performance. It's one of their main places to perform. And it's got a fabulous glass curtain created by Tiffany and Company. And it's just an amazing landscape view of those two volcanoes. It also is famous for its murals by important Mexican artists, including Diego Rivera's Man at the Crossroads, which, you know, was the mural that was destroyed by Rockefeller.
Right.
Refused by Rockefeller it, well, they were in the process of painting it.
Right.
And Rockefeller says, wait a minute, Lenin?
Right.
We can't have Lenin at the, here we have basically a tribute to Radio City Music Hall, kind of a tribute to American capitalism, and we're not going to have Lenin on this. But so Rivera will actually paint it, repaint it in the Palace of Fine Arts. So it's a building worth going to, an exhibition worth going to down in Mexico City till February 4th.
Yeah, you know, I have to tell you, you don't think of something like red being an import. You don't think of it being a thing. It's a color.
It was tremendously important. Yeah. And that's why cardinals wear red. Royalty wears red. Very often you see a portrait of a king. He'll be in red.
All right, listen.
Purple's the other key color because it takes its hard.
No, just but you don't associate it with, you know, in this case, this unfortunate insect which ends up getting ground out. Anyway, I can't
sum it up. Sorry for the insect?
No, it's just I don't think of it as a thing. I think of it as a color. But I mean, in the same way of thinking, we now have this movie called The Shape of Water, and I bring it up. Let me explain. The Shape of Water, this is a review in the New York Times by A.O. Scott, is a partly code-scrambled fairy tale, partly a genetically modified monster movie, and altogether wonderful. It's a romance between a woman who is a mute and a creature from the Black Lagoon, who, in circumstances which are too difficult to describe, finds himself the subject of experiments, and in this photo, in this woman's bathtub.
It's really willing suspension of disbelief,
yes,
isn't it?
To an nth degree.
It's hard to believe that it could be a wonderful movie.
Right. So part of me says, come on, that's too far. And now I'm reading about it and I'm thinking, it might be good. Might be worth seeing. They have a nice squib of an interview in the Times with Guillermo del Toro, who of course made, I think, Pan's Labyrinth, made a lot of movies, and he's talking about this movie. And he's a very down-to-earth guy.
Did he make this movie?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, as a matter of fact, they ask him quickly, I mean, are you like those other directors? Say, what's your favorite movie? You say, well, I can't choose among my children. And he says, no, nonsense. Some of my children I wouldn't take on a long road trip. Okay? And then they ask him about this movie. And strangely, he says, well, it's kind of a takeoff on Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And they say, what do you mean?
I can see that.
He said he was asking himself when he made it, can we make a Beauty and the Beast sort of a story in which Beauty is not a princess on a pedestal and the Beast doesn't transform into a boring damn prince? This is Del Toro again. And this is actually kind of interesting. He said, I think when we think of love and people think of transformation, that's the most horrible trick romantic love stories have ever played on us. Love is not transformation, it's understanding. And that obviously informs the movie.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
that's nice.
It is nice. You know, again, all I'm really saying is something that looks like it's worth seeing. Maybe this is the best movie of the year, I think. I wouldn't be surprised, but we'll know when we see it. But the Times reviewer, A.O. Scott, head over heels, and here's how he closes the review. He says, in Mr. Del Toro's world, reality is the domain of rules and responsibilities. Realism is a crabbed, literal-minded view of things that cannot be, that can be opposed only by the forces of imagination. This will never be a fair or symmetrical fight. And the most important and the most important reason to make movies like this one, or for that matter, to watch them, is to even the odds. So, we're going to see that movie.
Okay. After we see Thor.
After we see Thor.
You promise me we're going to see Thor. Thor, yes. Probably Thor's not even
the Shape of Thor. Yes, we'll be watching that. You had a dessert you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, another article by Gabrielle Hamilton in the magazine section of the New York Times.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a fan of hers, a fan of her writing. I don't know. Maybe she's getting a little caught up in the writing at this point. Anyway, it's entitled Fire and Ice. Attention to detail makes all the difference when combining a baked Alaska's disparate elements. So I'm a big fan of baked Alaska. That's, of course, cake, ice cream, and the meringue on top. And she has a recipe. She starts the article saying, baked Alaska is a simple ice cream cake, but with the tension of a good novel. Will the delicate protagonist, the ice cream, survive the flames and the beauty of a poem? It was a work of art, one guest said at the end of her meal, but nothing could be further from the truth. It's all craft.
Huh.
And then she goes on to say, well, yeah, I mean, it sounds sounds pretty hard to make the way she does it. okay, that's good. I guess that's what we want in an article. We want something to aspire to.
Right.
I do love a good baked Alaska, I think...
I'm looking forward to it because I'm not going to make it. It's going to be you.
Right. I think I'll run out to the store and get a pound cake at the Giant Food, buy some ice cream, whip up some eggs, and just do it that way. I don't have a torch, but...
Christmas
we'll figure out something there. And she does end it by saying, no matter what happens, it will be good because ice cream cake is always, no matter what, a delight.
All right. We're in agreement there. Just quickly.
Do you remember what they call baked Alaska in France? In French?
No. Yeah.
When we were in Corsica.
Yeah.
Like 100 years ago at a very charming restaurant, and a waiter went by with a baked Alaska, and we said, ooh, qu'est-ce que c'est?
Yeah.
And they said, it's a Norwegian omelet.
Oh, that's...
Which makes some sense when you think about it.
No. But in any event...
You know, Norwegian, snow, ice cream, omelet, eggs.
Yeah, in our science section, not surprisingly, increased attention with respect to batteries. There's so much that has to be run by batteries. There's so much attention paid on energy sources, generally speaking.
We're looking for all kinds of energy.
Yeah. Right?
And we got to find some way to hold on to it.
Well, we do. We in particular...
There's all this sun.
People
it has
in Australia.
Energy. How do we hold it?
So the Australians basically benefit from both a lot of sun and a lot of wind energy. 40% of their energy... is from the wind, from windmills. But what they're not very good is, as Tamsin describes, holding on to it. And as a result, energy is very expensive there. And they have regular blackouts. A solution, according to Elon Musk of Tesla Motors, is to build a battery the size of a football field. And he's done it. He actually went to the folks in Australia.
That is a big battery.
And he said to them, here's my proposal. And I'll do it in 100 days. And if I don't do it in 100 days... you get it for free. And he went and he did it in 100 days. So we'll see. I mean, there's like any other political issue, some people love it, some people don't love it, but it looks like it's a step forward. At the same time, I couldn't help but notice another article about batteries this week. This has to do with advances in fuel cell technology that came out of the Mars landing project. It's basically a bunch of wafers stacked together. It looks like a deck of cards. But if you run natural gas through it, it creates so much energy that it's running these co-location facilities, these power facilities where people use to nest their various internet technology. And it's now being installed throughout. A company called Equinix has contracted with a company that makes this called Bloom to install this all over the country. It looks pretty amazing that it has so much...
Well, this is very exciting. These large batteries, these small batteries,
right.
all these different...
And the great thing is, of course, if you have the fuel source on location, you don't lose it in the travel. In other words, when you are taking energy a long way along power lines, you lose a lot of it. on the way.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes, you do. And this, you don't. If it's on site, it's extremely efficient. And not only that, but this doesn't give up much in the way of carbon dioxide gases and the like. So it's very ecological. So in any event, a lot of developments on that front. The we also found an article, which was kind of interesting, about Chock Full of Nuts. And this is...
Well, that wasn't interesting.
It is interesting.
It was just kind of funny.
It's interesting. Because here's what... It's a marketing challenge. So let's say you were marketing a coffee called Chock Full of Nuts.
Can I tell my Chock Full of Nuts story first?
No.
Later?
I'll tell you when it comes in. All right? You're marketing Chock Full of Nuts. And you're marketing outside of New York, where no one's heard of Chock Full of Nuts. New York people get it. They know what it is. But you know, you're marketing...
Chock Full of Nuts is that heavenly coffee. Heavenly coffee. Heavenly coffee. I could go on.
Yeah, you could. I can't get you to sing Sondheim, but that you'll sing. But in any event... Yeah, so they're trying to distribute it throughout the country. They pick Omaha, Nebraska. And guess what people are concerned about when they see Chock Full of Nuts on the shelves in Omaha, Nebraska?
Allergies.
Nut allergies.
Yes.
They say, how can we buy that? It's Chock Full of Nuts. And they say, no, don't worry about it. There's no nuts in the coffee. They say, interesting. And yet it says Chock Full of Nuts. And apparently that affects sales. So they have a picture of a can here. The can says on one side, presumably Chock Full of Nuts. On the other side, it says, no nuts. It's in huge letters, no nuts. But they're meeting real resistance in marketing the coffee. It turns out the story is that the guy who started the company a zillion years ago was a guy who had a small space underneath some stairs in the 40s, in the West 40s. And he started by selling nuts. And he wanted to branch out in his business, and he branched out by buying green coffee beans at the exchange at the Bronx Terminal Market and roasting them because he had an old roaster. Now he was selling coffee also, selling date nut sandwiches with the nuts, and suddenly he was in business. But it started as a nut store, Chock Full of Nuts. So now what I'd like to hear, if you have a Chock Full of Nuts story, this would be a good time to tell it.
Well, you know, there were Chock Full of Nuts shops all over New York. And when I was first working for Allied Chemical, I would stop in. There was one, near my building. So get off the subway, run into Chock Full of Nuts, and it has those ladies at the counter who within a day or two know what your order is. You don't even have to say a word. You walk in and, you know, as soon as you get up to the front of the line, you're handed your usual.
Right.
And so I would go there every day and take the coffee up to my desk and drink it. And one day I'm sitting there drinking the coffee and I get to the bottom of the cup and there's a nut.
Right.
Like as in screws, nuts, bolts and nuts, and nuts and bolts.
Right.
It's a nut.
Right.
A metal nut in my coffee.
And?
So I didn't run down and sue them or anything like that because I said to myself, I just smiled and thought, well... It does say on the cup, Chock Full of Nuts.
That's right.
So I can't really complain.
It's an absolute defense.
I still have that nut.
Really?
I love that nut. So there was another book article in the New York Times. And, of course, we read this article because it was written by somebody named Sadie.
Sadie Stein.
Sadie Stein wrote this. And it was about... career romance books that apparently were a thing starting in the late 40s. And for a while, I think I read a few.
Did you?
I read like the Cherry Ames at some
point.
Oh,
they mentioned that. They mentioned about nurses.
Nurse books, yeah. And, that was all very, there was a lot of fuss about how they got their hats and what kind of ribbons were on it. But that's all I remember. But anyway, she goes on to say she collects them. And she describes what kind of books they are. Some were more serious than others, actually trying to teach you about the industry, stenography, copywriters, social work, home economists, nutritionists, all these kinds of things. And, she discusses just what a phenomenon they were. Some of them were fairly formulaic, as those kind of books can be. You know, there were all those series books during that period, just a little bit before, around when we were born. And by the time we were reading things like this, they were probably the books our parents might have read. But what were you interested in about?
Well, I mean, this is new to me. I mean, the titles are all great. I mean, like Aerospace Nurse, Weddings by Gwen, Ginny Williams, library assistant, hostess in the sky. I mean, they're fantastic titles. They have a few squibs here. I'll just read a couple of them to give you a sense of them. And
well, we should mention that they weren't all professions that were totally in the realm of girls only.
Right.
They weren't all for home economists and wedding planners, which is interesting.
Yeah. But a lot of them were, and there were stories that eventually would sort of have romance or not have romance. But on the other hand, some of them, as they explained, would just be ones in which the main character would eventually listen to a long description of her prospects given by some more senior person, more senior woman, who was able to give her some avuncular advice.
In fact, they say that here's the formula. Young woman comes to the city, learns a career, vanquishes a rival, is attracted to a caddish smoothie, but ends up with a good guy.
Ends up with a good guy. That's what they all said. But anyway, here are some squibs that came to our attention.
Sort of how I expected life would be.
Yeah, and it was. So here are the titles that you might be looking for this holiday season. Number one, designed by Stacy. Unabashedly ludicrous, worth reading for the apartment description alone. Lee Devon's copywriter. Welcome to the fast-paced world of department store ad copy. Lori, physical therapist. Proceed with caution.
It says this is among the really weird ones.
Right, but this is the best
finally,
one.
Finally, Carol Stevens, newspaper girl. By Jane Campbell, 1964, narrowly beating out the similarly themed front page for Jennifer, this is the story of an ambitious journalism student who rises through the ranks of the Gazette, all the while foiling an elaborate Cold War spy ring and helping an injured child learn to walk again, as one does.
As one does. And this is the kind of thing that you'd expect from Tams and Dan. Read the paper. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks.